the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues. Here's today's guest host, Eric Townsend.
I'm Eric Townsend for the Financial Sense NewsHour. The Next Level is a new weekly program segment intended for investment professionals and more advanced private investors. This week's topic, Let's Twist Again, a post-FOMC macro update. Joining me as my special guest on the program is Dr. Chris Martinson from peakprosperity.com. Chris, thanks for joining me on The Next Level.
Eric, it's my pleasure.
Most Financial Sense listeners know Chris Martinson as the man behind the Crash Course. And for anyone who doesn't already know, Dr. Martinson has a gift for explaining complex topics so that anyone can understand them. The Crash Course, without a doubt, is the best tool in existence for explaining the global economic predicament we all face. There's both a book and a movie version. As with most things, the book is better than the movie, but the movie requires less commitment. And if ever there was a way to educate the people in your life who may not follow this stuff as closely as you do yourself, the Crash Course is it. Most of Dr. Martinson's public interviews have focused on the Crash Course, whether it be with Jim Poplava on the Financial Sense NewsHour or elsewhere. Today I'm going to introduce you to a different side of Chris Martinson. So Chris, what I'd like to do is call in a personal favor here and ask you to share some of the deeper macro analysis that you normally reserve for your paid subscribers at peakprosperity.com. A lot of people see this year as a repeat of 2010 or 2011. They're expecting the second half to involve some economic softness. Maybe markets are down 10 or even 20% in a correction in equity markets. Then the economy recovers late year. But you see things very, very differently. In fact, you recently said that if this year rhymes with any other, it's going to be 2008, not 2011. And you're actually predicting a massive downturn in financial markets, probably retesting the March 2009 low of 666 on the S&P within the next 6 months. But you emphasized when you made that prediction that that was unless and until there was a major central bank intervention that pumps new freshly printed money into the markets, which you thought would be likely in an election year and could very well prop the markets up and keep them going for several more months. Now, we didn't get QE3 on Wednesday. We got Operation Twist extended at Wednesday's FOMC meeting. Was that the big central bank intervention necessary, or do you still see a major economic correction coming?
Oh, you know, 10 years ago, Eric, we would have said that was a pretty significant move, but it was actually a non-event. It was basically $250 billion, but with Operation Twist, what's happening is the Fed is simply taking one asset off of its books and replacing it with a different asset. So it's taking short-dated treasuries and swapping them out for longer-dated treasuries. And so it's balance sheet neutral, which is a fancy way of saying no new money got printed. And until and unless we get new money, we are running an extraordinary risk of another liquidity crisis here. And I wasn't that surprised that the Fed basically stood pat with this relatively meaningless Operation Twist. You know, and it's meaningless to me because with treasuries at 1.5%, driving them down to 1 eventually or below, it's really the incremental benefit. Like if you're not making a loan at 1.5%, you're probably not going to make the loan if it gets to 1%. On a percentage basis, the yields look like they're making big moves, but in real world on the street terms, it's meaningless. So I don't view this recent Fed action as having much meaning. And the reason I wasn't expecting them to do anything meaningful is that I truly believe that the next round of central bank intervention has to be fully coordinated. It'll come off schedule. It'll probably be a bit of a surprise. We'll find the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, the ECB, the Federal Reserve, all coming out, holding hands one day and saying, world, we've decided we need 5 trillion freshly printed units out there. And that's what it's going to take. And the reason I hold that view is that a lot of the central banks, you know, when they're just twiddling around with their balance sheets, basically not really expanding them, all they're doing is assuring that the markets have liquidity where they need them. So the Fed's going to take a little liquidity away from the short end of the Treasury market, and it's going to give liquidity to the long end. So they're just basically redirecting where the hoses are pointed. But ultimately what we need to deal with and face up to is that this has not been a liquidity crisis. 2008 says this is a solvency crisis. And so where we have Lehman as an insolvent institution in 2008, the rhyme this time in history is going to be, well, we have Greece, obviously, as an insolvent entity. We have Spain as an insolvent entity, Italy as an insolvent entity, Japan as an insolvent entity. In fact, all of the OECD mainly, except with a few very minor, except, well, not minor, but Germany being one, and a couple of the Northern European countries as others. But the United States, even at the core of this all, is fundamentally in a position where its assets and liabilities do not line up in a favorable way. It is an insolvent entity under the current architecture of tax flows, economic growth, and spending patterns.
A lot of people have been trying to align the FOMC meeting schedule with the potential of, you know, is there going to be QE3 at this FOMC meeting or is it not till the next FOMC meeting? Sounds like your expectation is not at any FOMC meeting, that this is bigger than the Fed and the FOMC, and that what we're going to see is no particular action in FOMC meetings until we get a major coordinated central bank intervention between the Fed and several other entities, BOJ, BOE, ECB, and so forth. When do you think that happens? Is that a pre-U.S. election event, or is that a post-election event, or not sure yet?
If we're hoping to avoid a really painful downdraft, and by really painful, it's something that could potentially tear the European Monetary Union apart. It could upset a derivative market. It could take down a major banking institution or set of them in a domino series. If we want to avoid that, it's really got to come, I think, within the next few months, let's say 2 or 3 months. The signs of stress out of Europe are just extraordinary. You know, they've got political sclerosis. They've got institutional sclerosis. It's the countries can't quite agree. You know, France wants this. Germany wants that. What they need is they need quick coordinated action, and they're not getting it. And if we don't get that quick coordinated action, there's a very real chance of the European banking system and financial system and entire monetary system pretty much cracking apart with unknowable impacts. And the reason that I think that this has to be a coordinated central bank action is, first of all, Europe is too large for Europe to solve by itself. And second of all of these interventions that happen do upset the Forex markets, right? So Japan is really upset with the strength of the yen right now. They would not want to see it get any stronger. So just, you know, thought processing this out. If all of a sudden just the U.S. and Europe came out and went through liquidity, you know, measures and printed money out of thin air, very strong chance that this would just simply drive the yen higher. And of course, that might topple Japan. So that doesn't work. In order for a large, sizable intervention to happen of the magnitude necessary to deal with the gaping hole that exists right now in the solvency issue, I think it has to be large enough that it has to be coordinated in order to avoid upsetting the Forex exchange for simple trade reasons, but mostly because of the derivatives that are parked above and across those Forex trades, and also to make sure that the interest rate derivative markets don't get upset.
So essentially, lining up the dominoes, you would expect several more weeks of Europe continuing to deteriorate, the news getting worse, more bailouts or faux bailouts or whatever you want to call them going on. Eventually, the situation gets really, really bad, and it's clear to everyone that it's really, really bad. And at that point, we wake up one day, and there has been a coordinated central bank intervention which prints $5 trillion or some, you know, very, very large amount of money that is designed to keep everything going and hopefully reboot or restart or somehow extend and pretend the European drama one way or another so that if it does come to a head, it comes to a head after the U.S. election. Is that what it looks like in your mind?
Absolutely. You know, I do know that Europe mostly shuts down in August. You know, I have an expectation that we could easily limp through the summer in this current, you know, we're going to have another summit, you know, there'll be more announcements, you know, the Spanish yields spike, they plunge. This could carry on for a bit longer. There's no particular pressing urgency that says this has to happen today or tomorrow or next week. So I could see a few more months of this carrying along. And then in the final analysis, when I do see this, you know, $5 trillion or $10 trillion or $50 trillion, it's meaningless to me what number ultimately gets printed up. You know, I wrote a piece back in, must have been 2008, called The Sound of One Hand Clapping, and it was really a response to deflationists who were telling me, and you know, widely proclaiming that you know, deflation had to happen because the central banks couldn't do certain things. And I don't like definitive statements like that. And so the sound of one hand clapping is a thought piece that asks this question. It says, so what if the central banks decide to just go out and buy up, let's say, all of Greece's debt, to make one example out of this, but any sovereign debt, buy it up, put it on their balance sheets, and just, that's it. That's all that ever happens. It's gone. They don't redeem it. They don't mark it to market. It doesn't, you know, they just, the whole world, all the major central banks look at each other and go, yeah, we'll give you a pass on that. We, you know, it's essentially, it's the possibility of a state-sponsored jubilee, if you will. I don't understand technically why that's impossible. You know, optically it looks horrible, and we can say a lot of reasons why we wouldn't think that makes, you know, good fiscal sense or monetary sense, but it could happen. And so I'm really looking for this next big, when I say there's like some coordinated $5 trillion central bank announcement, they're going to have to go out and vacuum up the worst of the worst debts with that stuff. And those will be the pieces that, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, that are sitting on bank balance sheets right now, creating the largest risks for those banks. So whatever those pieces happen to be, and that'll be a big chunk of sovereign debt, that's going to be a whole bunch of these bad mortgage-backed loans, it's going to be a whole bunch of corporate debt, too, that I think is going to go bad in this process. And I think that's mostly going to get vacuumed up in one more attempt to try what already hasn't worked, using the same methodology that got us into this predicament in the first place, but trying it bigger.
What is your prediction with respect to the ultimate outcome? You're saying there's going to be a huge coordinated monetary stimulus event. Do you think there's any chance whatsoever of it actually succeeding in its intended purpose in bootstrapping, say, a return to organic economic growth in Europe? Or do you think that that's just an impossibility at this point?
You know, that part, the return to organic growth, is just fingers crossed, sort of a hope on the part of central banks. I don't think they understand the mechanisms really well. What they're going to do, and their stated target and their intended target, will be to drive asset markets higher. And that's the tail, and they hope it wags the dog, which would be the actual organic economy that exists out there. They will be very successful in driving asset prices higher. At least in nominal terms. The model for this that I have in a recent post, which was titled More Stress is Needed, is the Zimbabwe stock market. You know, that went up, I think it was some in the vicinity of 12,000% in 2007, and then, you know, really exceeded that in 2008. Extraordinary gains. But they ultimately were meaningless in the larger face of, you know, were those real gains? That's a different question. So the whole strategy of Europe has always been extend and pretend, for starters, but then that now they're just into the praying mode, and what everybody's praying for is growth to return. We need growth in this model. We need organic growth to be very, very high. The one thing that history has taught us is over the past four decades is that everybody at the state level has been increasing their debt loads faster than the rate of underlying economic growth. So, you know, the hint under all of this, the only thing that could possibly start to square the circle is for organic growth, this is real economic growth, let's call it 5% to return, and for state debt growth to be at something less than that, call it 4%, call it 3%, call it 2%, something less than that. Instead, what we've been seeing for decades is real growth of maybe 3% and debt growth of 4 or 5%. It's really going to be extraordinarily difficult for politicians, especially in the socialist states, you know, where as long as 51% of the people vote for their self-interest, if 51% of the people are supported by the state and they vote, and they usually do, what you're going to find is that I think my prediction would be that even if we do get organic growth coming back next year at 3%, that you'll find the states continuing to expand their debts at 4% or 5%, because they'll just go, hey, look, we're back to growth. And we proved before that under growth models, growth can be 3%. We can expand debt at 5%. And there's no difficulties. It's just it's the most extraordinary tendency of humans to say during an emergency, this is a bad time to tighten our belt. And when good times return, to say, see, belt tightening is never necessary.
Hearing you speak there, I was thinking about what's going on here in Europe, and definitely the return to socialism, or the increasing popularity of socialist political candidates, is a very strong trend here. So where does all this lead? You know, as you said, Europe's been pretending and extending for a long time, and they've been getting away with it so far. And we've had an evolution. People talk about extend and pretend, eventually morphed into delay and pray. So are we in the end game yet, or is Europe going to successfully print enough money to keep itself going for another 10 years here? It feels to me like we're coming close to the end game.
Well, we are in a process. This is not going to be an event. It is a process, and we're in that process. So the deconstruction of this credit bubble is underway. Here we are. And Greece is already the first victim of this, and Spain will soon be a victim of this. And Ludwig von Mises said it best. You know, he said there's only two possible ways to get out of a credit bubble at the end. It's either you voluntarily abandon further expansion of credit, or you face a final catastrophe of the currency involved. And so that's really the knife edge that we're risking here. And is, you know, on the one hand, are we going to go down this deflationary path? Europe, you know, fears that greatly. It was, you know, that was something that they've seen tear things apart before, but they fear inflation just a little bit more, especially in Germany and Austria. And so, you know, they're trying to walk this knife edge between, do we let this whole thing fall apart, or do we risk this inflationary piece? And, you know, the third thing that needs to be tossed into that is, well, the currency itself is at risk here. And when currencies break, that's an extraordinarily socially and politically disruptive event that takes generation or more to get out from under. It's just, it can really break the back of an entire country. And the larger question that really needs to be looked at here is, listen, we have a debt-based money system. It needs to grow constantly. If you grow it at a somewhat appropriate rate, you can carry that game on for a very long time, especially if your native economy is growing with that. But when you're growing your debts at a faster rate than your underlying economy, the breakage point arrives sooner than later. We've already hit that breakage point. There's no way to put this back together again under current understandings of growth that might possibly arise. And so what has to happen is we have to say, listen, we live beyond our means for a period of time. Do we want to risk destruction of the currency involved, or are we really going to figure out how to live within our means? That's the great battle that's happening. There are losses that have to be taken. The banks are saying not us. The governments are saying not us. The citizens, to the extent they have a voice, are saying not us. Iceland, a perfect example of that. And so those three parties are all sort of trying to square off and figure out who's going to be left holding the bag, but there is a bag that has to be held here. And that's just, I think, you know, the thing that's remarkable in this is that the simplest, easiest understanding of this, which almost no politician has come out and voiced at this point, is to say, listen, we overdid it. We're going to have to spend less. We're probably going to have to tax more to balance the books at the government level. The private balance sheet is going to be no better off because in part of spending less at the government level means entitlement programs are going to have to be cut. Well, those cuts just simply transfer the expenses back to the people who thought they were going to be receiving those benefits. You know, somebody has to hold that bag and cover those costs or the losses as they exist. And so eventually there just simply has to be a period of belt tightening. That's if we're going to do it in a way where I think you could really maintain the integrity of the system. Now, the other way, of course, is to have the socialists or their equivalents get voted in, whether that's in the U.S. or in Europe. There's flavors of in both places. They vote in their favorite people who say, no, retirement age, and we're going to keep that at the same. In fact, I might even reduce it a little bit, and don't worry, everything we promised you is going to be forthcoming. We're going to keep spending at the government level. We're going to keep your taxes low. You know, that story is the one that got us into this place. It's a very compelling story, and it unfortunately doesn't work. So my prediction is that we're going to see a defense of the status quo right up into the point at which it breaks. And if listeners want a model to look at to understand what this process is going to look like, you could do no worse than Greece. Greece right now is a complete economic disaster. They're to the point that there's a shortage of food, of medicine, of energy, petrol, electricity. Companies are not filling orders simply because they can't carry the cash of those orders, waiting for the other party to pay. So their economy is basically frozen. You've got an entire generation of workers under the age of 25 or even 30 at this point that is lost. They're not developing skills. They're developing bad attitudes. There are no options. There are no jobs for them to pursue. And that is what happens when the end game is finally reached and it finally breaks. And the delusion here, I think, would be for the larger entities out there, say the United States, to think, well, yeah, that happens to peripheral countries, a lot weaker ones, but it could never happen at the core. There's a risk this can happen at the core.
Here in Europe, do you think that this is going to be the last round? In other words, the Europeans have gotten away with extending and pretending quite a few times now. They've printed some more money, issued some more bonds, and managed to extend the nanny state, what feels like indefinitely, for several decades now. Is there a reason to think that we're at a limit now where the next, say, one or two money printing rounds are going to be the last ones before we see those epic collapses, or could this go on for several more years?
I think that the first limiting feature in Europe is that, in fact, they're not doing a whole lot of printing at present. What they're asking is for German taxpayers' savings to be tossed into the open mouth of this furnace and get consumed in this process. And this thing in Europe really depends on Angela Merkel being able to continue to politically maneuver the taxpayers of her country into coughing up their savings in defense of the larger European experiment. And it's unclear to me that she's going to be successful ultimately in allowing all of the savings of Germany to be burned through. And at such point as it's revealed that Germany is really, you know, lost an incredible amount by participating in this system. And in fact, you know, the bulk of the savings of a very productive country, I think, well, A, her political career is over at that point in time, but whoever follows is going to really be faced with, you know, only one of two choices: eat all of those losses and be facing, you know, a ruined Europe, or be lured by the idea that, you know, that was bad, we're really sorry about that. It seems like the way out of this, of course, if we could just print a little at this stage, this would be a way to sort of repay you. Don't forget to spend it quickly because, you know, in process of seniorage will apply. This money will be losing value rapidly because we're just going to have to print here now. I do believe that the lure of printing will ultimately take over again. History is clear on this. It's just so much easier politically, institutionally, if the alternative is seeing the whole continent fly apart, potentially leading to types of unrest that, you know, are very traumatic. Or printing will be tried again. Absolutely.
Something I've noticed just being on the ground here in Europe is that the popular press is starting to pick up things that were only in the financial press just a few weeks ago. In Germany, the popular press has now picked up the idea of target two imbalances, and more German citizens are waking up to understanding the mechanisms through which they're really paying, you know, the brunt of the expenses associated with this. I don't think they're going to stand for that anymore. And it appears to me that we are on the precipice of a cataclysmic event in Europe. And I think, as you said, it's the Germans saying enough is enough. So far, nobody in Germany has been willing to say, okay, look, we're going to take the political risk of Germany being blamed for the breakup of the euro because we need to protect our own investment, not bail somebody else out with it. I think that once they get through that political barrier of not wanting to be the kid that said, let's go ahead and take the blame, if that's what it comes down to, for the euro falling apart, I don't think there's anything left to hold it together once they get over that political stumbling block. What would you say to that? Do you think that that's true? Is there another way out for Europe if Germany stops playing ball? Is there anything that can be done, or does the euro fall apart at that point?
You know, it's important to really understand how the system works, and I know it's very complicated, and there's a lot of acronyms, and it's very difficult to figure out where the money is coming from and all this and that, but ultimately it's as simple as this. Europe had built up an extraordinary amount of debt located in some regions and quite a big pile of savings in another region, mostly in Northern Europe, mainly and principally in Germany. And so the way that these credit bubbles, when they do burst, the first act of that credit bubble is to rapaciously tear around the landscape and chew through whatever buffers happen to be there. Well, that was German savings. And there was some very direct, very obvious stuff where Germany ponied some stuff up to these stabilization funds and things like that. And, you know, the people squawked about that. And right underneath that, hidden out of view, were these Target 2 imbalances where the central banks on their own were squaring up cross-border currency flows in order to maintain some integrity to the system. And it turned out that, you know, Germany is now owed an extraordinary amount, which the German people may have been largely unaware of. Because of the technicality of it. And the system has now burned through the bulk of what Germany can offer. Not all of it. Maybe we've got a little more buffer so we could get a few more months or maybe a half a year out of that. But when that's gone, it's gone. And then that system will rapaciously look around for what's next. And if there are no more buffers or stores, you are now at the starting line of the next phase of this. And there's only a couple of ways that you can run this race. One is you can print, and two, you can just allow this whole thing to sort of fall apart and let the chips fall where they may, and that's where the losses have to be taken. That's the process that's really scary. So I just want to think back to, look, Greece was, you know, clearly in default, and the derivatives body that was overseeing the derivatives, there were, what, maybe $78 billion of credit default swaps outstanding on Greek debt. And they just hemmed and hawed and gnashed and couldn't figure out, were they going to call this a credit event? And they were doing rhetorical contortions to try and, you know, prevent this whole thing from being recognized. And no good explanation really came out, but it was pretty clear to me that what was going on was they were kind of scared to, like, trigger a credit default swap. Even in this tiny corner, $78 billion is chump change compared to the total size of the CDS market. And but even that, they were, you know, scared in the to see what might happen. And the actual the notional value was $78 billion, but the actual value at risk, the amount that would have to change hands, was maximally $3.8 billion. But once you got through the auction process afterwards, it was going to be maybe 1.8, maybe $2 billion. And so even $1.5-2 billion, they were afraid to let that sort of unfold, because I think they didn't quite know where the counterparty risks were on that. So I think their hemming and hawing was to make sure they understood who all the parties were, could they pay, you know, because if just one counterparty doesn't pony up in a derivatives chain, it really exposes the whole derivatives chain to just sort of a cascading series of losses that just sort of proceed until it ends in a buffer somewhere. And so if we got into this larger crisis where all of a sudden it's really a Eurozone crisis and we're all of a sudden saying we can't support, you know, we're not bailing out Spanish banks, and now all of a sudden instead of $78 billion of outstanding credit default swaps, multiply that number by 10, maybe by more, just for Spain, and multiply that number by 2 just for Italy and so on, it suddenly becomes quite unknowable. And that's the scary part. It's just uncertain. We just simply don't know what will happen, which institution will fail first, who are the counterparties to that, under what terms, under what agreements, which contracts. It's just a mess. And the shame in this story is that 2008 had the shot across the bow, and that was the wake-up moment where we should have said, ooh, there's some extraordinary risks here. Where are they? How can we get our hands around them? How can we reduce them? And my assessment is we did not take that crisis to heart. We just papered it over, you know, wiped our sweaty brow off and said, whew, you know, dodged that one, and never really took the next step, which is to say, how do we start to unwind the risks here? And the risks were this concept of too big to fail, right, which somehow morphed into, became institutional policy of some sort, and I think has morphed into, worse, something that we might call too big to save.
Let's suppose the Germans don't play ball, and we do get at least a EMU breakup, if not an EU breakup. What does that look like? Does that mean instantaneous contagion to the rest of the global financial system? Does it just mean Europe's in trouble and potentially gives a competitive advantage to other jurisdictions that are not in trouble? Let's say the big European event happens this summer, Labor Day, 1st of September-ish. What happens after that? What do you think the fall-on effects are going to be?
Well, let's just start with the simpler case, even though this is complex enough, with an EMU breakup. There, I think we have our first, you know, sort of approximations of what governments are thinking over there, where they've got planning committees that have already met and said, whoa, even if just Greek, you know, we have a Greek exit, the Grexit, from the euro itself, so we just have a partial sort of disintegration at the edge and a lopping off of just one portion of the EMU, presumably with the remaining portion all remaining intact. Even under that light scenario, the planning bodies have already said, well, here's some things we have to think about. We have to think about capital controls across all borders in Europe, not just to and from Greece. We have to think about limiting ATM withdrawals. We have to think about potentially shutting our borders down. You know, to the open policy of travel in Europe would have to be closed because they're worried about cash flows. I don't know if you caught it, but an Italian, some poor Italian guy just had 1.7 million pounds, meaning the English version of money, worth of gold seized at the border as he tried to, you know, get into Switzerland. So they're talking about actually, you know, shutting the borders down to prevent the flow of hard cash and gold and other physical assets from going from place to place. So you would basically see the disintegration at that point of the free flow of money, goods, and then probably even services at that point. We're talking essentially at that point an economic lockdown. And that would be precipitated, of course, by the financial lockdown that would have to happen because all the banks, the whole system is just one big interdependent system. There is no French banking system anymore. You can't just say, well, if we had, you know, there's this problem with these Spanish banks, so we'll just isolate it so we don't get this contagion that spreads to France. We'll just, you know, shut the financial borders. It doesn't work that way. If you understand who's holding whose debts and what the counterparties are and how interlinked these are, the banking system doesn't have borders anymore. And so it's unclear to me how you don't go from an EMU breakup very rapidly into a seizure of the financial system itself until we work out a lot of details. And that could be a very, very, at best, a very unpleasant 1 to maybe 3 month process of essential closure and freezing of just, you know, everything. And that's something that I don't think most people have really figured out what the risks to them, their portfolios, their personal situations might truly be. And because A, it's unpredictable, but B, not in its disruptive capabilities. There we could predict some pretty extraordinary disruptions if that happens. And again, we might be talking about something that has a fairly low probability, but the impact of that is so catastrophically high that I think everybody has to at least be wrestling with it, even if there are no good answers and it's unknowable how this might play out.
I want to move beyond Europe, but before doing that, what else do you see that people should be thinking about that maybe not everybody's talking about in the Europe theater specifically?
Here I'm just, you know, I'm just like everybody else, just every single day waking up and you know, peering through gapped fingers at the headlines that are coming in across the wires from over there. I think we have to be just aware of the idea that it's very difficult to come by really good hard information about what's truly happening behind the scenes. So we have to read the smoke signals and read between the lines, do whatever we can to sort of divine what's happening. And what I'm really smelling out of there is panic, in essence, that nobody's dealt with this before. It's moving extraordinarily rapidly. You know, it's a circumstance where when things finally come, I think they're going to come much faster than most people are anticipating, that it will, you know, we can feel the pressures building. We understand that something's really wrong. We're not entirely clear what, you know, we don't know who's, you know, suddenly driving interest rates this way or that, or how much control the ECB really has, or what's going on behind closed doors, or what sort of things are being promised, you know, on secret phone lines. We have no insight into any of that. I think we just need to be aware of history here, which says that the European Union was a grand experiment. It's been a very interesting one. It's been very productive. But the terms under which it was constructed were so fatally flawed that it really, there is no possible resolution to it under its old terms. It's going to have to go through some sort of a reformation. I just can't see how that's going to happen without a convulsion, because it seems like politicians are unable to truly respond in a proactive fashion. So I'm just looking at reactive behaviors that ultimately history suggests eventually will swamp the participants, and my prediction would be it'll swamp it much faster than most people are expecting and anticipating.
So you think something really big is going to go down in Europe and probably be contagious from Europe into the rest of the global economy, and you think that's probably going to start in the next 6 to 12 months?
Yeah, and you and I and other people who are paying really close attention, we might get a couple of weeks' warning, and we'll see credit spreads blowing out, and we'll see mysterious gyrations in prices of key financial stocks, or there'll be some sort of warning signs, just like we had in 2008. But ultimately, most of the world will wake up one day, and it will be announced that the German banking system is now isolated from the southern banking system in Europe, or something like that. It'll be a relatively quick announcement that'll catch most people off guard. It'll be, this is how these things tend to unfold. In Argentina in 2000, there were all of these pressures building. The Argentinian government was running out of foreign exchange reserves to pay off its debts, which were denominated not in their local currency. So they really needed those foreign exchange reserves to pay the interest payments and the principal payments on outstanding debts. They were running low. This was obvious to everybody who was paying close attention, but the vast majority of the Argentinian populace was really disappointed to wake up one day and discover their bank accounts were frozen. If they had dollars in those bank accounts, when they got access to their bank accounts 2 weeks later, they found they didn't have dollars in their bank accounts. They had pesos on a one-to-one basis when a peso was worth roughly 30% of what a dollar was worth. So it was an effective, two-thirds theft of their wealth. That's the kind of thing that happens. It happens really suddenly. It seemingly comes out of the blue, but in fact, there are plenty of warning signs that something like this is happening. And that's why we saw, starting over about a year and a half ago, the really big money was taking its money out of Greece. The fact that, there are Greek banks that still have a lot of deposits in them, I can guarantee you almost all of those belong to what you might call the more average investor or depositor.
Almost all eyes have been on Europe because that's where most of the action has been, but you're one of the few analysts that has been quick to point out, hey, wait a minute, the problems don't end in Europe. There are other macro risks. You wrote an excellent article recently about the unwind of the yen carry trade that I'd like to pick up on. I think most of our listeners are familiar with the basic concept of a carry trade. You go to Japan, you borrow a whole bunch of money in yen because interest rates are cheap. You convert those yen into some other currency where you can get a better return, say New Zealand treasury returns or something, and you've effectively arbitraged interest rates between two different countries, made a profit doing that. I think everybody understands the basic concept of a carry trade, but you did some really interesting analysis on why the yen carry trade is unwinding and what the likely ramifications of that will be to Japan. Could you explain that to our listeners?
Japan, for 10, 12 years had this extraordinary advantage on the world scene where, they had the lowest interest rates in what we might call the safe world, probably in the whole world, actually, if I stop to think about it. So you were able to borrow in Japan at effectively zero, which was a really tasty rate, something maybe some less than 1%, and go out and then, invest that in New Zealand bonds at, say, 4, 4.5, 5%, a very safe trade, and you could do that on leverage so that you weren't just earning 3% on your capital, you might be earning 10 times that amount. So, it was an extraordinary lucrative trade to run on, and it went for a very long time. And so in the basic mechanism of this, it meant that, people were going in, borrowing yen, selling those into the open market because you can't buy a New Zealand bond with yen. You need New Zealand dollars. So they would sell the yen, buy the New Zealand dollar. And so ultimately that served to weaken the yen. Japan loved that because a weaker yen, of course, kept their exports going, and they are a nation that imports 99% of its energy, and it lives by its ability to take raw materials from the world, transform them into wonderful products, export them, and that, of course, is greased. The skids are greased by having a weak yen, and so the carry trade really worked in its advantage. And then the world really shifted and changed, and it did so pretty remarkably, rapidly by financial standards, where all of a sudden Japan's yen advantage and interest rate advantage just evaporated, because people suddenly could get much lower interest rates elsewhere, say the United States even. And so what ultimately started to happen was people started to reverse that carry trade, and the exact opposite pattern happened. You know, New Zealand bonds were sold. Those New Zealand dollars were taken out into the market. Those were sold. Yen were bought. And in that buying, it started to drive up the price of the yen. So this is one of the most extraordinarily weird things. You have Japan at the very time that its economy is now doing very poorly. It suffered through an extraordinary natural disaster and then a nuclear disaster. And its government has one of the worst debt-to-GDP ratios on the books at over 200%. And there's just not a lot of reasons to be favorable about the yen. And the yen is going up and up and up. And this is just starting to create worse and worse problems for Japan. It's killing its export markets. It's just creating extraordinary stress over there to the point that for the very first time in, I think it was about 31 years, Japan this past 6 months slipped into having an export deficit, not a surplus. And that's a huge tidal shift. And still, there's the yen, still strengthening and being very strong, and it's just this weird, mysterious process. It has nothing to do with the fundamentals. It has everything to do with the carry trade. And that unwinding process, the winding of that really was very helpful to Japan, and the unwinding is proving to be very unhelpful. And so as I look at Japan, I'm looking at an island nation that still, the Fukushima disaster is going to cost it a lot more than it ever thought. It's got a lot of internal expenditures to rebuild from the other destructive damage of that earthquake. And they've got weakening of exports all across the Asian rim at this particular time. So their export figures do not look good right now. And they're in recession. They've got this demographic issue. The litany of issues that Japan has to deal with are enough that I think that Japan is really, it's my black swan candidate for 2012. All eyes are on Spain. Look at Spain. What are we going to do with Spain? But in reality, the nation, I think, with the largest structural and fundamental problems on the books right now is Japan. And there, I'm looking for the unwinding of the carry trade to drive the yen up until it's basically all done. And I think we're pretty close to that process of it being all done. And then I would expect a reversal of that process in the sense that pressure driving the yen stronger and stronger eases up. Meanwhile, pushing against that pressure is the Bank of Japan, which is doing everything it can to get a weaker yen, right? They really, the strong yen is not helping them in the larger sense across its industrial base. It's very helpful as they have to import more energy, particularly liquefied natural gas and coal to replace the lost nuclear power. So it's helping them there, keep their import costs down a little bit, but it's definitely killing their exports. And so, I'm looking for the Bank of Japan to just like all central banks do, to keep leaning against this thing they're trying to change to the point it's like, like if you had a kid brother like I did, was leaning against the door trying to open it, and then you just opened it all at once on them. I think that's going to be the Bank of Japan stumbling across this threshold where they will suddenly find, for a lot of very good fundamental reasons, the yen weakening really strongly. And at that point, Japan's got an extraordinary problem on its hands because the only way that you can defend a currency that's starting to weaken beyond a safe point internationally is to raise interest rates. Japan's interest rates, on that 200%+ debt to GDP are extraordinarily low. Let's call it zero for all practical purposes right now. If they had to raise interest rates in Japan to just 3%, and if they started to have to pay 3% on their sovereign debt, at that point, 100% of Japan's internal tax revenues would go towards interest payments on that debt. It's game over. So Japan is at this really precarious situation where they've got almost no maneuvering room in this game, and they are counting on the game simply not changing under them. As long as the yen doesn't get too weak or too strong magically all on its own, as long as Japan can continue to print and run these extraordinary fiscal deficits, as long as they can continue to ignore the outflows of money that are going to an increasingly retiring population that is no longer putting into the system but drawing from it, as long as they can continue to somehow ignore that they were funding all of their extraordinary purchases of treasuries on this side for a variety of reasons, forex management being one of them, as long as they can ignore the fact that they no longer have surpluses coming in through their current account because they are now on a trade deficit, not a trade surplus territory. As long as all of those things can be ignored and continue to trundle along, Japan's just fine. As soon as one of those things changes, or more of them, or as these things tend to happen in sequence and collectively change, what we'll find is that Japan at that point in time is utterly insolvent, and that can really only be squared up with an extraordinary wipeout of one form or another, and that's, or a destruction of the currency involved. That's where we're at. And so I truly think that Japan has a very strong candidate of being that black swan candidate for 2012. We will detect it first in gyrations in the yen trades that exist out there, so the value of the yen on the international market, particularly against the euro and the dollar, but also the yuan. We have to watch its China pair as well. And there's really just not a whole lot that's truly working in Japan's favor at this point in time, and they're going to have to deal with that, I think, this year.
To summarize, the situation in Europe, there really is no structural solution for. If you forget about solutions and just look at keeping the house of cards propped up for another round, it's hard to do even that much without the cooperation of Germany, which has a good reason not to cooperate with that agenda. Meanwhile, Japan, which is a very important industrial producing nation, is dealing with immense hardships that normally in a natural course of events would weaken Japan's currency, making it easier for Japan to sell its exports and recover somewhat organically. That's working in reverse in Japan, where instead of the currency weakening, it's strengthening, and it's strengthening uncontrollably as a result of this carry trade unwind, and there's really nothing that the Bank of Japan can do to stop that at this pace. What about China? That's another one where I think we've got some more macro risk.
Well, China is the 800-pound gorilla in this story, and it's, on the one hand, I've seen a lot of reports that have definitely talked about decelerating growth. So, again, this is not recession territory. It just means that instead of growing 9% or 8.5% or 8%, maybe it's going to grow 6.5%, maybe 5%. But that deceleration is quite worrisome because so much is hinged on just the voraciousness of China's economy. And let's be fair, it was China's economy that I think in large measure really kept the world out of much more perilous situation over the past 3 years or 4 years, because it was just growing at extraordinary rates, 8 and 9%, and it was just consuming all of these natural resources and commodities from Australia and Brazil and oil from all over the world and, resources from Canada. So that flow was really quite instrumental in keeping world economic flows going. And, China's got just the most extraordinary growth story under its belt, and I think it's got more to go. The only reason I could see China truly slowing down or breaking in this model is if somehow their financial system doesn't work. I've read a bunch of analysts who were convinced that, China's just gone up too far, too fast, it's a bubble, it has to break. I'm less convinced. I think that there's a structural advantage that China has, which is that the type of command and control economy they've got, they are able to dictate things at a level that allows them to more readily deal with the larger structural issues that are out there. One anecdote being that 6 years ago, China was really nowhere on the alternative energy market, and they set a goal for themselves to be number one, and today they are. And that's the kind of thing where if you're waiting for market forces to sort of dictate that to you, you might get there through, some tweaked tax policies and a little bit of guidance and some good capital markets, but China just made it happen. So they have the capability, I think, if they do face a pretty significant banking crisis, to just do something that Europe can't, which is to just reach into the banking system and go, great, that's no longer a problem. We've taken those assets that seem to be impaired, and here's a whole bunch of fresh money or something like that. I think China has a few advantages in that. China's got its own long history of knowing that it lives in a very fine line between being a very, very controlled culture and one that's flying apart at the seams. And with the number of jobs that need to be created in order to provide a sense of mobility and purpose to a very, very large underclass and growing middle class, they've just got to keep that train going. And I think that China has the capability to keep that train going by by force of edict, by force of will, by mandate, by however you want to look at that. What numbers I can track when I'm looking at the import statistics for China in terms of energy, those have slowed down some, but they're still importing more. And energy is the key thing that I'm always looking at in any culture. Like, if you're using more energy, you're having more economic activity is a pretty good rule of thumb. And so, you know, there's been a little bit of a hiccup in some month-over-month data for China in terms of its energy use, but you know, on a year-over-year basis, it still looks pretty favorable. So cautious, keeping my eye on it, not entirely clear what's going on, don't entirely trust the data I've got, but I think they've got some advantages.
China's been very vulnerable in the last couple of years to commodity price inflation, particularly food prices. Do you think that the coordinated central bank money printing that you're expecting elsewhere in reaction to the European crisis, say, poses a macro threat to China that will lead to food price inflation that will create riots or unrest or other problems?
Yeah, let's be clear about this. When we get our coordinated OECD central bank print-a-thon, at that moment, I personally, in sympathy and in coordination with millions of other independent minds out there, will just go all in on all kinds of things, meaning I'm going all out of paper currency at that point in time. I am personally waiting for that announcement. I've got cash reserves that I've been building up for a number of months, and those will be deployed really rapidly. And I'm deploying them into hard stuff, things, commodities, commodity funds, futures, maybe physical things that I can get my hands on, silver, gold, whatnot. I think those decisions will be made all over the place. And so, yes, the asset markets will spike, which will be much to the benefit of the OECD central banks, but two, we will have this spiking in commodities. That's where I do think you're right, a pressure point for China. They have been running actually fairly significant food inflation costs over there, in part driven by, just what's been going on in the world commodity markets and world food prices. I mean, just look at the quarterly earnings statements for Kraft, P&G, companies are really exposed. All of them talked about double-digit, 10-11% input cost inflation for them that really sort of squeezed their margins. Well, yeah, where Kraft gets a little squeezed on margins, China gets squeezed, culturally. And so China at some point, if inflation gets bad enough, has to decide, are they going to allow their currency to rise in value to offset the impact of that or not? They've been very reticent to do that because they're still riding that. It's still much to their advantage to be riding that export market game. Where that might change, and the only place I really could expect it to change, is if there happens to be a pretty decent slump in terms of their exports to the rest of the world, because the rest of the world isn't doing that great, and at the same time we still see rising commodity costs. That would be sort of your stagflation model. That's an entirely possible outcome. The world central banks print, and they do everything in terms of asset markets and commodity inflation, but the tail, for regrettable but understandable reasons, just doesn't wag the dog again. It turns out that this next round of printing covers up some bad debts, treats some of the symptoms, but it doesn't fix the patient. And so there we could find that stagflationary model where, yes, we see rising prices for assets, including commodities. No, we don't actually see economic growth coming along at a fast enough pace. So China finds itself squeezed with rising input costs and stagnant to declining exports, and that's a bad model for it. China is becoming a really voracious importer, and so their export surpluses have shrunk a lot, and here and there on a monthly basis have actually turned negative briefly. So they're kind of dodging at that zero bound line. They're down at that place, and it wouldn't take that much for it to tip into more negative territory. And when you're suddenly more of an importer than an exporter, that's where having a weaker currency is not as much to your advantage. So the question here is, can China organically wean itself off of being a somewhat export-dependent nation, get internal demand up to a point where it no longer really needs the rest of the world? Let's be honest, China is a large enough market to pretty much service itself. The place where China is exposed in this story is they are not even remotely close to being energy independent, so they're constantly spending money on importing energy. So that's why they do need to continue to export so they can import their energy needs, which is the primary reason any country wants to be export positive.
So to summarize, we've got Europe arguably on the brink. Neither you or I can see any real solutions to Europe's problems. And even the things that might be undertaken to kick the can further down the road or extend and pretend or delay and pray would probably require Germany's participation. And we're questioning whether Germany really has good reason to want to support such policies. So Europe could really be on the brink. Japan is in a horrendously precarious position right now as a result of the unwind of the carry trade, strengthening its currency at the worst possible time. Meanwhile, 47% of Australian GDP is export of coal and iron ore to Japan and China, and you have some concerns about China. With all these things in mind, what do you think the world looks like 12 months from now? Do we still see the S&P teetering along at 1350 or so, and we've somehow managed to keep all these problems under hat, or do you think that we've mushroomed into full crisis by then?
The basic analysis that I've had on the books for years now is simply this, is that our institutions and our political systems are really, really heavily incentivized to continue to perpetuate status quo. They want business as usual, and they will do everything they possibly can to sort of engineer back towards those solutions. And my analysis is that we're in a whole new world. It's a very different paradigm. This credit bubble is over. It's not only unwise to attempt to perpetuate it, it's not possible. And the longer we attempt to do the impossible, the worse the final resolution to this actually becomes, meaning, you know, we just take a few more steps up the step ladder and then we have a little bit further to fall. And so even though that's true, in my mind, I also expect that our vaunted fearless leaders are going to do everything they can to ignore that and keep pushing. I don't know, Eric, when that break point comes. I just know that if something is unsustainable, someday it'll stop. You know, anything that can't go on forever won't, right, Herb Stein. So we're in that moment where it's really obvious to a lot of analysts that we're in a completely unsustainable situation. And for those analysts who see it that way, it's such an uncomfortable period of time because we're watching the leaders attempt to sustain the unsustainable, attempt to do the impossible. And it's awkward and it's uncomfortable and there's this sense of, you know, it's like that yellow sky right before a really big storm hits. And for some of us, and myself included, it's just like, I'm ambivalent because on the one hand, I'm like, can we just get on with this? And on the other hand, I really am not anxious for that moment to arrive either because I think it'll be really potentially disruptive. It's unnerving because I don't know what's going to happen and I can't predict. It's a chaotic, complex system, both when the break is going to happen and how big the break will be are just unknowable. It's like trying to predict earthquakes. You can't. It just defies our best abilities. So, you know, that's on the one hand. On the other hand, I know that what they're attempting to do is literally impossible. So, you know, what do you and I do? Well, we do the best we can. We try and figure out where the risks are. Even though we don't know what's going to happen and when, we can always say that, you know, with enough snowfall, that cornice over there is going to someday break off and we'll have an avalanche under it. I just can't tell you when. And so if you know an avalanche is very likely and it's still snowing heavily, which is the metaphor I have going in my mind here, what I do is how do I step aside from that avalanche? And there are lots of things that individuals can do. And I know we're getting at the end of our time here, but, you know, at peakprosperity.com, we have a lot of very specific individual advice for individuals. I'm starting to consult more and more with organizations, corporations that have caught on to this. And this is the interesting part in the story. It seems like pretty much everybody except the governments has started to really figure this out and starting to ask the good questions, you know, around, you know, corporations asking, how do I defend my supply chains? How do I become resilient? Well, how do I manage currency risk under this environment? You know, there's all sorts of questions that really there are no good answers under the old model. We have to figure out new ways to measure ourselves, new things that we might apply to figuring out what our key performance indicators are going to be, new ways to manage risk, And for me, as always, you know, when you're facing the potential risk of a final catastrophe of the currency systems involved, there's, you know, you want to be in the safest money you can possibly be in. The world has already voted. They piled into Swiss francs, judging that to be a safe currency. They've piled into gold, judging that to be a safe alternative currency. That piling process has really only just begun. A very tiny proportion of the world's monetary assets are safely parked in Swiss francs or gold at this stage. So I do expect and also advise people to look for ways to first see the strengthening of those alternative currency systems over time and for them to gain additional exposure to them.
You mentioned peakprosperity.com. I want to come back to that as we close because you've got a few exciting things going on. One is the recent publication of the book. The Crash Course, of course, is very widely known to our listeners as the video version, but it's available in book form now and updated. But you've also got a brand new website with a new brand, a new look and feel. Tell us what it's about. What's going on at peakprosperity.com?
We've spent probably about 8 months now behind the scenes, carefully first polling all of our users in terms of what do they like, what do they not like about the old site, what new features and functionality would they most like to see, and doing the best we could in the time and resources we had to give some new features. Peak Prosperity is around our mission, which is how do we become more resilient and more engaged in any circumstance, however the future happens to unfold. And so there we've got the usual excellent analysis, articles, community discussions around all things financial, but we now have a sister site that goes along with peakprosperity.com called Resilient Life, where we have two very exciting new features available. One is a groups feature, which allows people to find each other either by geography, so by zip code or location. Sebastopol might be one, or Hong Kong might be another. Or by interest, and that might be, we've got interest groups, everything from homeschooling to what do the future jobs look like, to raising chickens, to permaculture, you name it, anything people are interested in as they peer into the future and think about the changes that might most interest them, they're organizing. And then a second big feature are wikis, where we have these extraordinarily wonderful forum threads where people have definitive threads on home energy or firearms or whatever people were interested in. They were just glorious with thousands of replies, but they got buried over time and the content got lost. So the wikis are our way of capturing that information, curating it over time, but really ultimately allowing it to be immediately accessible and discoverable. And so that's also a new feature that we've got available there. And so it just really overhauled, overworked, and we're very excited by how it's been received and how it looks, and it's a lot cleaner and works better. So that's our big advance and improvement for this year, and we'll still be tweaking and modifying that, obviously, as we go along.
So again, you can find more of Chris's work at www.peakprosperity.com. And that site does replace the former ChrisMartinson.com site. Much of the discussion at peakprosperity.com, as Dr. Martinson has just described, is about resiliency and preparing families for what the economy may look like in coming years. But also in the subscriber area, or enrolled members as they're called at the site, there is a fair amount of fairly deep macro discussion and analysis on the level that we've been discussing here today. So I hope you've enjoyed this episode of The Next Level. My guest has been Dr. Chris Martinson of peakprosperity.com. Next week on The Next Level, we'll be going back to the subject of precious metals markets, taking a look at the differences between COMEX futures and LBMA forwards, how each are collateralized, reserve ratios and bullion banking, the risks of unallocated bullion accounts and the gold carry trade, not to mention a whole lot more. My guest will be Jeffrey Christian of CPM Group, and it should be a fascinating interview. But for now, we're out of time. If you'd like to suggest other advanced topics or guests for future episodes of The Next Level, please email your suggestions to me through the Financial Sense website. For the Financial Sense NewsHour, I'm Eric Townsend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.